Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 13, interview with Frank Turner from Muktuk Adventures. Hi, this is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that quakes, quenches, and quickens you on the sport of dog sledding.
Oh, I hate this part. I can't figure. Three Q's?
This is the easiest one I've given you, dear. I know it's been a tough week.
Q. Frank Turner. I don't get it. What is it?
Frank Turner, Muktuk Adventures.
Whale blubber. Well, I don't get it. What is it?
Q. What else starts with the Q? Kua.
Oh, the Yukon Quest.
Yes.
Boy, that was brutal.
What race has Frank raced 23 times?
Yes.
This is his 24th time
doing
the quest. Actually, he's one of the initial people who helped continue and get this race going.
You know, there's a little bit about Frank on the internet about him being the dog whisperer. And I loved that line that they put in one of the posts or an article about him. And I thought, oh, what does that mean? And that kind of stuff. Until I heard this interview with him. He is such a soft-spoken but well-spoken guy. I was enthralled just listening to him as we talked. He was talking about the Yukon Quest, and more importantly, he really got into the dynamics of fear and doubt and overcoming those fears, and that's why we named this episode Everyone's Got Their
Eagle Summit.
You got it. Because we all do. And I really enjoyed Frank's conversation, understanding what challenges he went through in the race and how it affects us in life and so forth. So I'm hoping that you guys like it too.
Yeah, this interview truly is about more than just the Yukon Quest and Frank Turner and Muktuk Adventures. I think all of our listeners, Tim, are going to get something from it. He's very psychological, philosophical, spiritual. He touches on a lot of truths, and I enjoyed this interview a lot.
Yeah, so did I. It got me to think about more than racing. It got me thinking more than just competition. It got me thinking more than, well, the adventures of being on top of Eagle Summit. And he goes over this an amazing story of climbing and conquering Eagle Summit multiple times. But more than that, he touched my soul, because I, like many people, fight and struggle sometimes with overcoming different fears in our life and so forth. And he touches on that, and he talks about not only not doubting his dogs, but also not doubting himself and going forth and conquering those things that might be standing in our way. And it's a pretty good interview. There's some twists and turns in it that will probably get your attention.
Yeah. And on the dog sledding world end of it, we haven't had anything yet that really goes through the Yukon Quest. So since Lance Mackey, our last interview, won the Yukon Quest again last year, but he got more recognition, obviously, because he won the Iditarod. Kind of the Yukon Quest kind of has floated a little higher to the sea, so to speak. I don't know. Anyway, the Yukon Quest has become a little bit more prominent, but we don't know much about it. So this really did explain more about that particular race.
It did, and he talks about how the race starts in the different locations, and we won't get too much into that because he'll explain it. So we hope you really enjoy that, and we've got another interview with Dr. Tim right afterward, and Dr. Tim's going to be talking about
dental care. Brush your little teethy, poochies.
Oh, for the dogs.
For the dogs. Yeah, you, Mr. Never Floss.
Oh, well, just leave that one alone. Okay. Hey, we do want to make a shout-out to some folks.
That's for sure. Well, first and foremost, we want to thank Leslie Gillis. She turned us on to Frank Turner, and I was really glad that she did, because I really enjoyed that interview. Yes, and also we got an email from a Diana Danielson. Thanks, Diana. We're glad you liked Martin Boozer's interview. We liked that interview, too. If you haven't listened to that one, you really should. Sue Schofield from the Northwest Sled Dog Association. Hi, everyone, from the Northwest Sled Dog Association, also via the link from the Cascade Sled Dog Club. I did send out a bunch of emails to different clubs that I could find off of Sled Dog Central. So let me take a break for a second and just say, if your club has a newsletter, we would love to get the www.sleddogpodcast.com link on there so that we can branch out and let everybody know about us.
Yeah, what I'm finding is that we get more traffic, not only because people come, but also when Google and so forth, when people start to search for us, if other people have our link on their page, it looks better for our page. So if you do got a web page out there, a blog or anything like that, we'd love it if you just, you know, put us in one of your articles or just a little soundbite or even just put our little logo on your page. We'd greatly appreciate it. So thank you so much for that.
As well as newsletters from sled dog clubs or whatever other clubs you have. And we have a special shout out to our nephew Jonathan. He chuckles a lot when Uncle Tim cannot get the three adjectives.
You know, you make him so hard. It's just not fair.
So
Jonathan,
hard.
I'm going to make her call you first. And then if you get him, I'll put him on. So
anyway, we're so thankful that nephew, one of our family members, actually likes our podcast. So
yes,
that's really cool.
Us crazy people up in the woods.
Be blessed,
dogs.
Jonathan. We love you.
So hey, everybody, here we go with the interview. And we'll talk to you on the other side. And the interview with Dr. Tim will follow right after. Hey, Frank, thanks for joining us today. Frank, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started in dog sledding and I guess what you've been doing for the last 25 years?
Well, it was kind of a slow process, I think, in terms of ending up with the dog team. But it basically went from getting one puppy. It was a Siberian Malinois cross. I was up in the Yukon on holidays, and it was way back in 1973, and I was finishing a social work degree in Ontario, and I went back there and during that year decided I wanted to come back to the Yukon. And when I did, I wanted to get a friend for my first dog. His name was Skookum. So I got Chimo as a puppy and had two dogs, and that was good. Still no idea about, you know, getting behind a sled or anything like that. And then what really happened then is I ended up with a female that really nobody else wanted, and I think she may have been abused. I'm not sure. She was very timid, and that was the reason that other people didn't want to take her in. But I did. I liked her, actually, because of that. And it turned out that she was pregnant when I got her. Her name was Chico. And after that, I had Skookum, Chimo, Chico, and five puppies. And I bought a book about how to, because then I started thinking for sure about sled dogs.
Oh, that's great.
And bought a book about how you make your own harnesses and got a speedy stitcher and some webbing and a little bit of padding and found an old sled out in the bush that was kind of wired together. I don't know how old it was. It had metal on the runners. And that was the start of it for me. And it was just using the dogs to haul water from the lake. I was living in a little cabin at the time and hauling firewood in the winter time and just going out and just kind of really enjoying the experiences of traveling by dog team. And after a couple of years, somebody talked me into going into the Yukon Rendezvous Festival, which is a big winter carnival where they had seven dog race. I went into that and had a good time doing that, and it's kind of grown from there into running the Quest a number of times.
And you're still using the same sled to this day, right?
Well, the sleds have changed so much. Anybody that's into the dogs now, I mean, before it was really different. I remember, because the Quest is just celebrating the 25th anniversary this year, and Sonny Lindner, who won the first Quest, his runners were 2 inches thick. That's 2 inches thick because nobody knew what it was going to be like to do the Quest. And now, you know, people are running on carbon fiber skis. They're running on aluminum, all these kinds of things. It's just changed so, so much. That's just, you know, one of the obvious changes. But no, the sled that I've got right now, actually, it's a prairie-built sled that I really like. But I also have a sled that came from Europe that's made out of carbon fiber, but I like the prairie-built, I guess, a little better.
And with that in mind, I guess you've seen, now you've been in, is it 24?
24.
Or this will be your 25th year?
This will be my 24th.
Okay, correct. So 23 Quests. What about the Quest? I mean, there's lots of races. What do you like about the Quest that keeps you coming back?
Well, I was involved in the very beginning when the Alaskans, some people may be kind of familiar with the story, Leroy Shank and Rod Terry and Roger Williams, they're the ones up in Fairbanks that had the idea, and it was kind of an alternative to the Iditarod, because even back then, 26 years ago or so, the Iditarod started to change from what it was originally envisioned to be, which was to promote the legacy of sled dog, use of sled dogs, and it started becoming more and more high-tech and more suited for elite teams. They even back there had good sponsors, whether they were food sponsors or equipment sponsors. So the Quest was supposed to be an alternative to that, more of a down-to-earth, old-fashioned sled dog race that would encourage smaller kennels, more First Nation or Native people to be able to participate in it and keep that part of the culture alive. So I was involved in those early discussions and helping to organize it. So I've got a personal connection to the Quest that really hasn't diminished over the years. And I'm not that competitive. I don't run a whole lot of races. I like the Quest because it's a special time for my dogs and myself to be out there in a set of conditions that we normally aren't going to see on our kind of day-to-day thing. And that usually satisfies my competitive urges to go into the Iditarod or to many other races. So, and it's in my backyard, and it's just a great community event. It's kind of a celebration in the Yukon of the history of sled dogs. So I really enjoy that, and really haven't had much inclination to kind of to participate in other races.
So what conditions are you not used to that you see in the Quest that you don't see in your own home?
Oh, wow. Eagle Summit, the Yukon River. Certainly Eagle Summit and the summits that we go over are not places that you would normally take a dog team on regular training. So that's always a big challenge. Just the schedule that you get into in running the race really forces you to really push yourself to limits that would be really hard to simulate. It's hard to train. I mean, you try to, as much as possible, simulate the conditions that you are, that you're in for the racing. But those 10 or 11, 12 days are just so intense that your training can only, it really doesn't reach the same degree of challenge. So I guess it's just a personal challenge in the summits. You always wonder how you're going to do on Eagle Summit or going over American Summit if the wind's really blowing. And sometimes you're on the Yukon River and the wind is really kicking up pretty good. And if you get on glare ice and you spin around, you really don't even know what direction. I don't use a GPS or anything, so I don't even know what direction I'm going in. You got to get down and then start looking for scratch marks on the ice or see if there's any markers that are still standing and try to figure out, you know, where the heck you're going. And, you know, you usually don't do that in training. I don't train my dogs really hard anyway, because I'm always afraid of injuries in a race. You know, you're inevitably going to have some injured dogs just because of the changing the conditions during the race. But in training, you really, I don't go out of my way to look for those kind of more difficult sections of trail to put the dogs through.
Can you describe Eagle Summit to us?
Well, there's two sides to it. When the race starts in Fairbanks, then you come up the long, gradual side. You come out of a place called 101, where most people rest their dogs to get ready to go up. And then you're going up for, it's over 4,000, I think it's like 4,300 feet, and it's a long, long haul. And once you get up there, you go along the ridge a little bit. And then when you're on the other side, you're just dropping. You're just coming right down. If the wind is really blowing and it's wind swept, then you've got rocks up there. You're virtually out of control. I don't think anybody is really in control going down there.
Wow.
You can chain lock your runners, which means put some chains, some short pieces of chains that you wrap around your runners, and that's going to hold you back a little bit. But when you're going down there, it's so steep that the dogs are just, their weight is getting out in front of them, and all you're trying to do is maintain your balance so that you don't get knocked over. When you come up that section, then it's really, really not in terms of injuries. The risk isn't with injuries, but it's just so demanding physically. I know when I go up there, and certainly since I'm getting older, or anybody that has run it a number of times, it just kind of feels like your heart's going to pop out of your chest. Your heart's just beating. Sometimes your legs just start getting a little bit of cramping in your legs, and you're just trying to keep it going. And then your dogs are looking back. You really need strong, strong leaders in front of you, because it's not the place to start to become tentative about whether there's any doubt as to whether you're going to make it up, to the top or not. Because once you get up there, there's really no turning around.
So which way do you like to go usually?
Well, competitively, I've always done better actually going up it, coming to Whitehorse. And I think mainly that is that when it's in Fairbanks, I have to leave here almost a week before the start of the race, because I've got the drive up there. And then there's a bunch of mandatory meetings. When it starts in Whitehorse here, my dogs basically sleep in their house for the night before the race. And they're not going through a whole bunch of adjustments the way they are when we go to Alaska. So if I was going to look at it in terms of performance, then I always seem to do a bit better when I had the big teams, and when we were much more focused on the competition. I did better going from Whitehorse to Fairbanks. Eagle Summit has kind of been a definitive place for me. I've had some of my best experiences there, and I've had some of my worst experiences. I've got dragged down there where I behind the sled and reached the point where I could no longer hang on. And I think that's been the low point for me in all my quests. When my fingers finally lost touch of the stanchion, I just could not hold them tight any longer. And then away my team went down the hill, and I started walking down there expecting the worst, that a dog would have got dragged and somebody was really going to get hurt. And the only thing that I think that prevented that was they ran into another musher sled. Another musher had gone down before me, and their sled had flipped, actually, and my dogs went by their sled, but my sled kind of crashed into theirs, and that's what stopped it. And then the musher got my snow hook down. I think that's been my worst experience. One of my fondest experiences or most rewarding experiences, now I find I can be more effective walking in front of my team going up the hill rather than trying to push the sled. One of the worst things I ever did was, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, going up Eagle Summit, and I was just played out. And you always say, you know, the cliche, your dogs give 100%. So what do you expect of yourself?
Right.
And we reached the really steep part, and it just felt like this is where I was going to drop. And I stood on the runners and I whistled to them, kind of hoping that they might be able to pull me. And they just stopped. They looked around, and everybody wants to see happiness and joy and excitement and exuberance in their eyes of their dogs. At that moment, and I don't think I'll ever forget it, if dogs have an expression for disdain or disappointment, that's what they had in their eyes. And I just felt so totally inadequate at that moment. I didn't formulate a plan or anything. I just started walking up ahead of them. And you can't just walk up. You've either got to go up on your hands and knees, or you kind of walk sideways up the hill, this last part, which is kind of like the chute. And I got up maybe 25 or 30 feet, and you're just about looking straight down at them, and they're looking at me because we'd never done anything like this before. And I just whistled to them, and up they came. And I was sitting there trying to catch my breath, and they came up. My leaders came up to me. I had Birch and Tank, or Birch and Ella, at the time. They came up, and I patted them, caught my breath, And it, I don't know, it took me about six times to go over that mountain. And then I got to the top and I felt so exhilarated because I realized that I had never doubted my dogs not coming to me. I had never, ever, ever in the smallest fraction of a way ever thought that they wouldn't come to me. And at the banquet that year, Dave Monson, Susan Butcher's husband, and if anybody knows Dave Monson, they know what a good musher in his own right he is. He was the MC, and we were talking a little bit, and I was telling Dave about going up over Eagle Summit that way because he'd been over it a bunch of times and he's won the quest. And I told him about not doubting my dogs, never not believing that they wouldn't come to me. And he just asked me, he said, "Frank, what do you think would have happened if you hadn't doubted them? What do you think would have happened if you didn't believe in them?" And then I went to my wife and I said to Anne, I said, "I'm never doing that again," you know, because I didn't trust myself that if I was ever in that situation again, maybe I would doubt them. And maybe it would turn out really differently. Maybe with that doubt, they wouldn't come to me. Maybe they would have turned around and I'm standing up in the mountain and now they're going down the mountain with the sled behind them. Right. And you can imagine what kind of situation that is. So I said to Ann, "I'm never going to do this again." And then 2 years later, we're back up there. I'm 2 years older now. It's not getting any easier. I wish it could, but it doesn't work that way. And this time, instead of waiting, I can tell you one thing. I never, ever, ever stepped on those runners again. And if I ever step on the runners, well, that would be it for me. I would never get into that situation again. But what I do now, and I've done ever since, is I do walk in front of my team, and my team changes, not very much, but, you know, there's usually two or three, four dogs each year, and you get different leaders. And I always walk in front of them, and the team always comes to me, and I never, ever do doubt them. I always just focus on believing in them, and they come up to me. And that's the best times I've probably had in the race. And like I said, that same hill going the other way is where I've also had my worst experiences.
Frank, coming from Whitehorse over, you know, up that grueling side there, is how long does that whole adventure take from the time that you, start the really hard part?
Over Eagle Summit?
Yeah.
Climbing over? Well, it depends on the weather. I mean, one year, there was a group of us, Charlie Boulding and Dave Sawatsky, Linda Forsberg, and a whole bunch of about five or six of us. It took like 2.5 days. The wind was blowing so hard, nobody could get over there. And finally, Linda Forsberg, and she used to do freighting in Denali with her dogs. She was the first to leave, and she got her team over. But normally, when you're going up the steep side, when you're leaving Central and you go along the valley and then you come up some creeks that, I mean, can sometimes be a bunch of overflow or ice in there. But if it's a good run, if it's not blowing really hard, it'll take you, the total distance is about 25 miles. It'll take you about 5 or 5.5 hours to actually get over the hill itself. Probably to get at the bottom of the Mountain Eagle Summit to get to 101. I'm not exactly sure. I'm getting maybe 2.5 hours or something, 2 hours.
Okay.
It all depends on the weather. Sometimes you can just cruise over there, but it depends on the snow conditions and it depends on the wind. I know now, and this was the third route over Eagle Summit. This isn't the first route they picked. This is the third route. And I know that because my son was part of that group a couple of years ago that got up there and were up there for almost 24 hours and came off the mountain in a Black Hawk helicopter, which was really unfortunate for all the mushers involved. But, you know, the Eagle Summit has become a big part of the quest. Everybody likes stories, and you're always guaranteed stories on Eagle Summit. I hope it doesn't keep a lot of people from coming into the quest, because the Quest is a really good race. But Eagle Summit does present some real challenges that you're not going to really experience in training, because nobody would, I don't think, would go over that. But it all depends on the weather conditions, really, as to how long it's going to be and how difficult it's going to be.
Frank, can you prepare your dogs for that run? Is it one of those things where you just obviously prepare them as much as you can, and then they're going to have to kick in that extra effort to get up that? Or is it one of those things that you actually prepare for by running the same kind of runs in different places?
Yeah, you prepare in different ways with the team. To prepare them physically, you need to do, you know, some good, really good hill training. But I think as far as the preparation, it's, to me, the team, when you talk about a team, it's a very special group. And it's not just how you prepare yourselves physically, but it's also how you prepare yourselves mentally and emotionally. And when you want to take a team up there, you want to make sure you've prepared them physically, but you also want to make sure that you've also been equally attentive to their emotional, that they're a happy team. You would not want to take a team that is not happy with you, that you've overrun them, or you haven't taken care of their feet, or, you know, there's problems, gastrointestinal problems. You wouldn't want to do that. You want the dogs to be really happy, and you really want to have a really good bond with them. And you want them to be psychologically really not under stress. You don't want, a certain degree of stress can raise its performance, but not going into that situation. You're not going to be coercive. If you do that, you've lost your team. So you prepare them all the way along, the physical, but also the mental and emotional. And a lot of performances, it doesn't matter what kind of team you're talking about, a dog team, hockey team, basketball, football team. You know, when you get right down to it, in terms of when you're trying to achieve performance, it's going to be whether you're mentally and emotionally ready for that tournament. And everybody loves upsets.
Right.
You don't have to be the biggest, the fastest, or the greatest. But if you're not ready, that other team is going to get you, if they are ready. If they believe in themselves and they're out there and you're not prepared, you underestimate another team or you underestimate some conditions, then and you make poor judgments, and you're going to have problems. And that's what it is over Eagle Summit. Eagle Summit is there, but you need to be totally focused on it when you're going over it to have a good run. I mean, there's been hundreds of teams over the years that have gone up and gone over it. So it's not like it's, you know, a total nightmare. It depends on the conditions. When you go over during the day and there's no wind and there's lots of snow, it's just incredible, because when you're up at the top, you're just looking over the entire world and you just feel life isn't any better than this. But when the conditions aren't good, then it's something entirely different.
Frank, would you do me a favor and take a chance? We take a video camera next year so you can video for it.
Just in that moment, you know, you have time.
Yeah, just strap on another 20 pounds or so, right?
You always sometimes think that, particularly for your family or friends or your supporters, that when you're out there, because not everybody obviously is going to be able to get out there, but there's so many people that are involved in supporting you that allows you to be out there, that other than just trying to describe it in words, some way that would really capture the essence of the experience. But I don't know. I don't know if anybody's ever tried to take a little cam recorder or something to film it. It would be really interesting if they did.
And I don't know if it would actually capture it any more than what you just described. I think our minds pictured this
right,
wonderful aspect just now, but it's fantastic. Well, besides that, what else about the race do you, other than what we've talked about, what else do you really enjoy about the race? Is it the challenge of the race that you like with the summits and different things? Is it the competitive side, or is it just this, you know, speed? Pardon me?
Being alone.
Being alone.
Because
what about that?
There's a paradoxical thing. You know, when I first started running the race, I always felt more secure when I was running with other teams. So that, you know, if you got into a difficult situation, whether it's on a hill or overflow or wind and ice or something like that. Misery loves company. But what I really, really enjoy now is being out there with nobody else around. And you can do that in the quest where it's very difficult to do that in the Iditarod. It's just a different kind of thing. You know, when we've got 28 or 30 teams and they've got 80 or 85 teams going, that it's a different kind of thing. And so I really prefer just to be out by myself in the times where I'm going to see other teams and talk to other people will be at the checkpoints. Because it's kind of, the reason I said it's kind of a paradoxical thing, the way I see it, is when you're out there with your team, you describe it as being alone, because in fact you are alone. There aren't any other humans out there, other people. But at the same time, you're so connected to your team. You're so totally dependent on them. Because I'm not walking, I'm not skiing. If I'm going to get from point A to point B, it's going to be my dogs doing that. And they're so totally dependent on me. So at the same time that I'm feeling this kind of sense of my own being without having anybody else around, at that same time where that's a really heightened sense of, for me, it's almost like being alive. I live for those moments. At that time, I'm totally dependent on the dogs in front of me. So if it was a group of people, it would be totally different. But it's such a special feeling to be out there with my dogs and knowing if I take care of them, then they're going to take care of me. It, you know, I mean, it's like a cliche, but it's really, really true. It's pretty basic. And then it's just making sure that I take care of the things that need to be taken care of. And if I do that, then it's gonna be good for all of us. That's the hook, because I don't have that anywhere else in my life, that kind of feeling. I love the challenges of looking ahead, and you look at a mountain or you look at the clouds moving in and you know that's going to be a big storm and the trail's going to get blown over and it's going to be really difficult. And those are challenges, and you deal with it, and then a little while later, you're looking and it's all behind you. The mountain's behind you, you got up and over. Well, hopefully I haven't got always up and over, but that's what you're trying to do. I've had some moments where we didn't get over. That's really what you're trying to do. But the sense of being out there, it's just, I'm just totally appreciative of being alive and being able to be part of doing something like this.
Well, and Frank, let's shift gears a little bit. You guys have a business around the dog sledding community and guide service and so forth. Tell us, do the folks that come out to visit with you guys, do they get to experience that same kind of, well, maybe not the rush of Eagle Summit, but the same kind of experiences?
Well, they experience their own experiences. You know, it's not to try to, people say, well, I could never do what you do. That's not the point, to do what somebody else is doing. It's to try to find out what experiences are meaningful to you. So when people come out here, you know, we do it kind of, the guides will do an assessment of the condition of the person, their abilities, their skill levels, whether they've been on a dog team before or whether this is just kind of a dream because they've read a book or seen a movie or something of a dog team and they have this romantic image of being on a dog team under the Northern Lights. And we can do all of those things. What you try to do is, as much as possible, have the person articulate what would be the perfect trip for them. And then given the limitations that we have in terms of conditions particularly and their limitations and abilities or skills, then we try to put something together that as much as possible are going to come as close to fulfilling those aspirations. So the tours that we do, they're not formulaic, like every tour, day one is the same as the last day one, day two, day three. That would be too mechanical to me. So we've got a variety of trail options, and we try to vary those according to the individuals that we have in that particular group. So, you know, to tell you the truth, if somebody that comes here because it's kind of been a dream, and then they get here and then they start thinking, oh boy, I don't know if this is such a good idea, if I can deal with the weather, or these dogs look pretty big and strong, or this and that. And then they start having a little bit of that doubt. And then once they do it, then that doubt gets transformed into a particular kind of smile or kind of a sparkle in the eyes that they've done something that just a little while before they really weren't quite sure whether they can do. And that's really nice. We all have our ego summits, but they don't have to be in Alaska, and they don't have to be big mountains. We all have different kinds of situations that we deal with, and it's not necessary to compare it to another. It's just to value the experience that you've got at the time. And I think if you compare it to something else, you just diminish the meaning of that experience.
That is so incredible. How many years have you had this service or this, I don't know what you call it, company or adventurer?
I guess in terms of the organized, I mean, in the beginning it was just people phoning the one and come up for a ride. And then we thought, well, wait a minute, we'll try to do this. We've probably been doing this now for, I don't know, 10, 12 years.
Okay. So that's you've wonderful. Had probably lots of fun, lots of good stories, I'm sure, with lots of different.
Well, I enjoy the guiding, because after the quest, I do the guiding, and we get to meet really, really neat people that have a lot of their own stories, and kind of I can have a bit of the gift for the gab, I think. So it's really, really fun, and that's what you want. Every trip you take, life is about stories, and I mean, it would be really sad to me for people or somebody to go through life where they really don't have stories to share, or stories, even if they're not sharing it for other people, stories that they have within themselves. And with the dogs, it's always a good time. You know, you go out there and you know you're going to come back with stories. Some of them are going to be very funny stories. Some of them kind of be a little on the dramatic side, and those are the ones we usually remember the longest. But you guys have good stories, and I think anybody that has sled dogs, if you sat around and just started chatting, you know, people would all have many, many stories that you could do some really colorful books, I think.
For sure. Let's turn a bit to your dogs. Tell us a little bit about Yukon Territory dogs versus, say, your typical Alaskan dog, or maybe even the dogs that we would have here in the lower 48. Is there a big difference?
Well, I don't think in the Yukon. My dogs, I don't have any of the hound dogs in my breeding. My breeding is essentially, a lot of it is, it goes back to the older Reddington lines and Runyon, some Susan Butcher. My dogs are bigger. My males are usually 65 to 70 pounds. My females are going to, although I've got a couple of smaller ones now, are going to be around 55, some 60 pounds. So my breeding really hasn't changed very much. However, a lot of the teams that are running the quest now have bred a lot of the pointer, the German short hair pointer, English pointer, get them down to about 1/8 or so, I think. And they're the people that I've talked to that have that breeding, they're very, very different dogs. The personality of their dogs, they're just, they go, 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 go. I think a lot faster than certainly the bigger dogs that I'm running right now. So there's been a lot of changes, you know, and because our weather is changing so much, the farther north you go, the more pronounced the warming effects are. Like right now, I don't know what the temperature is with you in Michigan, but just around freezing right here, it might even be a little above freezing. We don't have a whole lot of snow on the ground, and that could be problematic because we're only a little over a month away from the race. So a lot of people are breeding smaller dogs, thinner coated dogs, so they're better able to deal with the warming temperatures. It used to be for me 40, 45 below zero. That's when I would really rock and roll. We would do our 8-10 hour runs, and we would go really, really well. My dogs were bigger, thicker coated, and that played to our strengths. Now, the probability of getting those temperatures is less and less and less. And as the temperatures get warmer, my bigger dogs are at a real disadvantage. It plays to the strengths of those smaller cross pointer dogs. When it's warmer, then they're going to do much better in it. So the breeding, certainly, it's not just for speed, but also in terms of temperature and overheating, heat stress. The little dogs, the breeding of smaller dogs and thinner coated dogs has certainly been, I think, very strategic.
So do you see yourself changing or no?
No. I just like my dogs.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm past the point where I'm trying to set any records or do anything. I just want to go into the race. Last year was the first time in many years. You know, there's a lot of cliches around, and one of them is just to run your own race. But last year truly was the first time in many years that I'd really been able to kind of set aside what we had done in the past, because there were a few years there that for the Quest, I had some pretty good teams in there, and we had the record for 12 years. Lance broke it last year. And so that's always part of you. And even though I would say, I just want to run my own race, there would be a part of me that also would be looking at the other teams, where when you're looking at other teams, then it means I'm not looking at my own team. But last year, I really managed to, I think, get it as right as I'm probably ever going to get it, to just go in and to run a race just with my team. And when I start doing my longer runs, 50, 60 miles on the river, I'm out there on the river, and there's nobody there, the team, my dogs, and myself. And when I go into the race, the Quest, that's the visualization I want to hold on to. Doesn't matter who's around me, whether Hans God is there or whether Lance is there or William Clean. Doesn't matter. All I've got to do is focus on my teams and not get distracted. And my ability to focus on my team and not think about other teams, I believe, is going to have a great deal to determine how well I'm going to do in that race. And I generally know first 24 hours or so, if I'm thinking about how other teams are doing, how fast they're going, how far they're going, and that influences my decisions for my team, then I'm giving control away of my team to somebody else. Last year, I just went in, and I was really disciplined and really focused. I ended up with a whole bunch of injuries that were really unusual for me in terms of the number that I had, and I can't really think of anything that I would do differently, to tell you the truth, that might have reduced those injuries. It's just, you know, they just happened, and you just have to accept that. But this year, that's what my objective is if I can go back in and just stay within myself, focus on my team, then I'll, at the end, then they hand out the numbers, and that's fine. Everybody loves a winner, and it's great to do really well like that, but I just want the satisfaction that I've run a good race. I've got a bunch of young dogs in my team this year, so they're not going to be running, you know, in a really highly competitive way. But, I mean, I've got a nice team, I think. So
oh, absolutely.
I just want to do the best we can, and that isn't measured. The best we can be isn't measured against anybody else's performance. It's just measured against our own performance.
Absolutely. And isn't that life-defining? If most people could look at anything that they do in life and not constantly compete with the Joneses or the other guys and just focus on what your purpose is, I think we would get further on in the race.
Yeah, the race, you know, what we do with the dogs is no different than what we do in other parts of our lives. I don't think you can fragment it out. I think if you listen to people at, you know, from the Olympics or other big competitive events, often they'll say the same things. We just played our own game. We never lost confidence in ourselves. We always believed in ourselves. Even when we were down 3-1, we never lost confidence in ourselves, because if you don't believe in yourself, in your team, if you're dealing with doubts, you never will do well. For that particular team, we hold ourselves back. So I think when you go into a competition, it's not going to try to beat somebody else. It's going into it trying not to beat yourself. to make, if you can make the right decisions at the right time, if you can give as much as you can, and this is where Lance, everybody's trying to beat Lance or figure Lance out, and I know you've talked to Lance about why Lance is doing what he's doing. Because, you know, you could buy the same food that Lance feeds. You could buy Lance's dogs. He'd sell you his team of dogs if you're going to pay him the money that he wanted for him. And you could even train with Lance. But until you figure out a way to put as much into your team as he puts in of himself into his team, you're never going to beat him. Everything else being equal, he's the difference. It's not because he's using supplements. It's not because he's doing anything different than any of the other top mushers are doing. But I'll tell you, I've seen a lot of mushers over the years, and if it's possible to give 100%, which I really doubt, that's where you leave nothing behind, nothing. Lance has come as close as I've seen anybody in being able to give of himself totally to his team.
That's awesome.
Wow.
And that's it. And, you know, if he loses his focus, then maybe somebody's going to come along and, you know, they are going to beat him, and he'll beat himself. But I think what makes Lance so special, and he's done it in such a great way, is this ability to unconditionally not hold anything back. And, you know, we like to talk in relationships about unconditional giving, and we know that dogs will do that. One of the things that we value in our relationships with dogs is that they'll give to us so unconditionally, and that's what Lance gives.
Yeah,
that's wonderful.
And I think it's just a lesson for everybody.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I think, you know, I sit here and I think about all the people that might come up to your guide service and get to, I guess, almost hold up the mirror when they do have that fear and that doubt coming in and creeping in, that they can look at that and kind of see that mirror and look past it to overcome and accomplish what you've just talked about of giving maybe not 100% on a day trip, but really looking at themselves and saying, what can I do here and how much can I overcome my fears and my doubts and get on the sled and go in a place that I've never been before? And I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what it's about. It's a relationship. The experience we have with the team. A team is a very special group, and it depends on how much the person wants to be a member of that team, you know, and that's going to vary between individuals. But a team is a very special group, and whenever anybody's a part of the team, I think they should try to get every bit out of it, of that experience, as they can, because it's a great way to be able to go through life when you are part of it. And I hope we get emails from people that have been here and or have been at other places, or you know, you've like taking friends out, and how they'll write back and they'll say how they remember that experience. It was a special, special time for them.
For
and
sure.
That's great. If we can have special times like that, I think we're doing okay.
Oh, absolutely. I can sense just through this interview why we've read a comment on you that you're the sled dog whisperer. Have you heard that comment?
I don't know. It's really changed. I think there, you know, one of the things that's really nice, because I have been doing this for a while, the way things are now, people's attitudes and the reason that people have dogs, it's just really, really good now. There's, you know, before when I started, it was still, I think, a little bit of a macho thing with the dogs, and a bit in the Yukon, a bit of like the Klondike legacy kind of thing. And instead of working with the dogs, understanding the dogs, there's still a lot of the relationship is based on power. Even the way people work with horses and other animals now, it's just so much better now. It is understanding the dogs as an individuals and understanding them collectively because a team to me, like you were asking about my dogs earlier, you know, when understanding the dogs, these are pack animals. They want to be in the group. That's their thing. They're not just happiest when they're sitting around by themselves. They can be happy doing that, but they're happiest when they're in the group, when they're in the pack. And that's all a dog team is. It's an organized pack, and you try to make it a win-win. It's a win for them because they're doing what they naturally or instinctively want to do, and it's a win for us because we get to go along and have a great experience with them and have those kinds of attachments to each of the individual dogs, because it's not like it used to be sometimes where dog teams were driven sometimes by coercion. Now it's dog teams doing what they really want to do and us learning a lot more about what we need to do to provide for them nutritionally and taking care of injuries, their environment, but how to do a really good job in taking care of them and allow them to be happy and go out and to do their thing. So, but I mean, I'm sure that you do that, and it's not unusual now. I think that's the prevailing environment in which sled dogs work now. And for me, it's really gratifying to see the changes. I've made all the mistakes you could possibly make. When I started and I went to an old timer, somebody that had been running dogs for a while, and I had a dog that wasn't pulling or doing something, then I could almost predict, you know, they were going to tell me, well, you take that dog and you just, I had an Iditarod winner like 20 years ago. I won't say who it was. I asked them about a dog that wasn't pulling for me. They said, well, you make that dog think it's got this close, putting their two fingers together, almost touching, going to the other side. But now we know there's thyroid conditions, there's kidney conditions, there's all kinds of things that affect performance. It's not that the dog is not wanting to pull, because naturally they want to pull. They're not all going to go to the Iditarod or go to the Quest, because we don't all go to the Olympics either.
Right.
So
right.
No big surprise on that one. But it's now the working with the dogs, I think, is done for a lot of right reasons rather than being confused about it and letting other kinds of coercive kind of maybe methods play a role.
Sure. Frank, what other passions do you have? Anything else that you'd like to talk about or bring up that we haven't touched? Is that really broad?
No. Mainly, my main thing is in terms of activities. Pretty well everything I do now revolves around the dogs. We do, you know, the tours and then the racing. And in the summer, I do a summer tour where people come up. I kind of introduce them to the dogs and our lifestyle with the dogs and do a demonstration of equipment at minus 40 and stuff like that. But prior to this, my background's in social work and was doing just a lot of community development work in the community. Well, community development work in the communities here. And so those, I'm mostly, I guess, you know, if you're going to have an epitaph, people mostly know me because of the association with the dogs. But I was very committed and enjoyed immensely working in communities, you know, trying to make changes there. So, but now my focus is just the dogs. So it's kind of let that other part of me rest in the background, I guess.
I hear you. Well, Frank, this has been wonderful. Is there a website that you guys have for your webpage?
We do. It's, I think, www.mukta.com.
Yep.
You mean we don't put www.whaleblubber.com?
No, not whaleblubber, huh? You don't know. Isn't that the
whale blubber?
Is that the name of it? We read
you know
that?
What Muktuk is.
Yeah, I was just teasing you.
How do you know what Muktuk? How did you know?
Well, we just do a little bit of researching before we do our shows, so I was just teasing you.
Oh yeah. Well, good for you.
And we love that you like the name of it. So I thought that was great.
Well, probably 30 years. I went up to the Arctic back then, and I heard some elders talking about Muktuk, but I didn't know what Muktuk was. I just liked the way they said Muktuk, Muktuk. I don't know how it happened. It just came to be that I started using that as the name for the kennel. And I have people up, you know, up on the Arctic that will contact me and ask me if I actually want Muktuk for the dogs.
Nice.
It's kind of neat.
That is wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And
wonderful getting to know you.
Well, it's been, I know that I rambled on an awful lot, but you made it easy for me to ramble.
Oh, heavens
on.
No. Nope. All so, good stuff. We're really thankful. And I know our listeners will be thankful as well. So,
well, thank you. It's been really neat making a connection with you guys in Michigan. And we have some people with us right now that have Siberians and some Huskies in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
And they run on carts there. And we've had people from Australia that have sled dogs there. And it's just so great because whether you run on carts or whether you run on snow, when people start talking about their dogs and the attachment that they have to their dogs and how special their dogs are in the world, then that's the most important part, I think, of what it is that we do. And that's the thing that keeps all of us interested in doing the best we can.
Absolutely.
Wow. Great interview, huh, Gene?
I love it.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. I joked with him about putting a camcorder on his, or a video camera on his sled. That would be absolutely riveting to see what that really looks like coming over the pass, coming over the summit. It would just be amazing.
I don't think it'd make it.
No, it probably would, especially if he's coming from...
I think it would be black, because it would be in the snow.
Yeah, it would be, yeah. That's it. I can't imagine trying to hold your dog's back, going down at that angle, coming down the hills like he was going.
What I loved was his sidebarring, but don't let anybody be afraid of Eagle Summit. Don't let it stop you from doing this race. And I'm thinking, no way.
No, I think maybe if anything, that might just inspire a lot more people to take the challenge, because it really is something that, I don't want to say it's in a confined environment, but it's a proven opportunity that people have done it, but yet could be one of the greatest challenges that people could take. I think that would be a great opportunity for people to try it. So if you've never tried the Yukon Quest, I hope you try it. And me with my little five or six dogs, I'm right there.
Go there, Tim. Yeah.
Any day now, huh? We'll try that. So here we go with Dr. Tim. And Dr. Tim, thank you so much for the interview. And here we go about
dental care.
Hey, so welcome, Dr. Tim. Tell us a little bit about the teeth or dental care.
Well, the good thing about sled dogs with their teeth, they rarely have issues because they're primarily on a hard food. And one way to get around having to have them ever cleaned by the veterinarian is to feed them bones. I think bones are fine for dogs if they're not cooked. So big femur bones always help clean up teeth. Regular hard kibble diets tend to clean up teeth very nicely as well. The other trick that works nicely if you're feeding a softer food like a lot of meat with just a little bit of kibble is actually to freeze the meat kibble mix into a block and then cut it up and feed it out like a brick, small chunks of it, like 6 inches at a time. If you watch the dogs, they'll actually chew and gnaw on it for a period of time before it's completely disintegrated, and that'll break the tartar off their teeth real nicely, and that's what I tend to recommend to a lot of sled dog kennels to do a few times a year. Do it once a day for a week or so, and it'll polish their teeth up real nice. So dogs these days really just chew on their back teeth. That's the ones we have to try to keep clean. They'll stain their teeth otherwise, but with those big dental calculi back there, the frozen meat trick works real slick, and again, bones work nicely too. Doesn't mean they can't have issues when they get older. They can break a teeth in a fight or in an accident or just plain simple with age. So you want to pay attention to their mouths and watch how they eat to make sure they're eating okay without any sort of a tendency to be tender in the mouth. And taking a look in there regularly just to see what it looks like. You have to know the normal to know the abnormal. So if you start early, the dogs get used to you fussing around in there. You don't need to be a dentist. You just have to know what it kind of looks like so you can tell when things aren't going well in their mouth. And that really is all the dental care there is that I've ever recommended with a sled dog. Puppies, again, you know, if you go back to baby teeth and adult teeth, the puppies will start to lose their adult teeth, or I should say the puppies should start to lose their baby teeth about 14 or 15 weeks, and then their adult teeth come in. There's really not much you have to do there. You don't need to tie them to a doorknob. They'll just start to fall out on their own accord. So we're lucky with the sled dogs in that they just don't have too many teeth problems outside of an occasional injury or a broken tooth.
Dr. Tim, if they do have a lot of buildup, is there anything particular that you recommend other than the meat? Should they take them in and get them cleaned by the vet?
You could. I don't see anything wrong with taking them in. It's just a matter of practicality in a lot of aspects. If we have a few dogs who want to do it, I think that's fine. If we have a lot of dogs and there's just no way to do it feasibly economically or just to get them in for that matter logistically, I tend to do the frozen meat thing. So No, there's nothing wrong with taking a dog and having them cleaned professionally, for that matter.
Awesome. And do you have a problem with, you know, those new whitening strips at all? Do you think that'd be, get bad for the dogs?
I think it would be great, especially for those Hollywood Siberians we always see in those sled dog movies.
I think they do use those.
Yeah, they've got to use those on those dogs because they have a sure nice hair coat. So.
How about those green dental things?
The dental bones.
The greenies? Yeah, I think greenies have their place. Again, trying to do a sled dog kennel with those cost-wise is pretty tough. But if you got a dog that wants to chew, those seem to help us somewhat with their teeth. But again, these big carnivores that we have out in our dog lot, I find the meat still, I go back to that. It tends to do the best.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Well, sure.
Thank you so much again, Dr. Tim. Great stuff. And I'm thinking that maybe I'm going to broaden out and start a new business. Those little whitening strips for people.
Yeah.
I think we should do them for dogs. What do you think?
Okay. What did that have to do with what Dr. Tim said?
He talked about getting
plaque off your teeth, not making your teeth whiter.
Yeah, I know, but I think the dogs would love it. Wouldn't they be cool? I mean, they'd be like shining. You go up to the race and people would be like, oh, that's a nice sled.
No, I think our dogs would love frozen chunks of meat because they don't get it.
I know. Okay, so frozen chunks of meat, whitening strips. I guess we'll stick with the frozen chunks of meat. Hey, thank you so much, everybody, for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show today.
Don't forget all the same stuff. Hey, if you're going to shop at Amazon, please go through our link. We so appreciate that. And if you got a newsletter or web page that you want to link us to, we'd love that.
And here's the last thing that I want to offer to anybody is we are going to start a tech or a product review section. So if you have a product and you listen to this show and that you would like some exposure, we would love to talk about that product on our show. So give me a call or give us an email, and I will talk about that product.
And will that product have to do with dog sledding, dear, or what is your point?
good point. If somebody sends me a VCR and wants me to review it, probably not a good idea. Well, maybe a VCR. No, yeah, I don't know.
You would be one that could.
Yes, exactly. No, I was thinking dog-related products. So if you have a sled manufacturer and you want us to talk about a new sled, we'd love to interview you and or talk to you and or take a look at it. You know, there was even a couple ideas that came out of Frank and I's conversation about different sleds that we talked about afterwards. So maybe I'd share that with you guys if you give me a call. So if you have any products and you want us to talk about them and get some exposure, the thousands of people that have listened and the hopefully thousands in the future that listen, we would love to share that.
Great.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
And be blessed.